I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sunday the United States is willing to hold unconditional talks with Iran to ease tensions between the two countries, but Tehran held out little hope for new negotiations. Pompeo said the U.S. is certainly prepared to have that conversation when the Iranians can prove that they want to behave like a normal nation. As VOA's Michael Bowman explains, Iran is downplaying that possibility.
For its part, Iran continues to downplay the likelihood of a dialogue with the United States so long as the Trump administration's pressure campaign against the Islamic Nation continues. In an interview aired on ABC's This Week program, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said President Donald Trump's way of doing things may work in a real estate market, but it does not work in dealing with Iran.
I've said it before, threats against Iran never work. Never threaten an Iranian. Try respect. That may work.
The foreign minister said he likes to keep President Trump guessing about what Iran may or may not do, but stressed that Tehran will not be deterred from operating in the Persian Gulf. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Syrian state media reports that an Israeli airstrike on a Syrian air base killed one soldier, wounded two others, and destroyed an arms depot. The attack on the T-4 air base in central Homs province came hours after Israeli airstrikes on the Golan Heights in southern Syria. Israel did not comment on the attack on the airbase, but said its strikes in Golan were a response to Saturday night rocket fire into Israel from Syria. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the Israeli strikes on the Golan Heights killed 10, including Syrian forces and fighters. This is VOA News. The U.S. State Department says it has updated its immigrant and non-immigrant visa forms to require almost all new applicants to provide 5 years' worth of social media accounts, telephone numbers, email addresses, international travel, and deportation status. They will also be asked whether any family members have been involved in terrorist activities. The new rules, first proposed in 2018, are expected to affect nearly 15 million people, including those applying to immigrate to the U.S. as well as those hoping to study, do business, work, or just visit. Only applicants for diplomatic and official visas could be exempt from the new rules. Previously, detailed information on personal activity was only sought from applicants who were deemed a possible security risk. An estimated 65,000 applicants per year fell into that category. The so-called special relationship between the United States and Britain comes into focus as Britain gears up for U.S. President Trump's visit Monday. Now, Trump is a controversial figure there. That's according to a recent YouGov poll that shows 67% of the British public with a negative opinion of him. And we get more from VOA's Patsy Wadakaswar.
London is gearing up for U.S. President Donald Trump's state visit beginning June 3rd. He's a controversial figure here. Polls show that the majority of the British public disapprove of him.
I think everything about him is awful. It really is.
Yeah.
He does. And he lies as well. He's very naughty.
How can a president that kind of behaves in the way he does and says the kind of things that he does, like, be allowed? Like, into politics, it's just, I think it's ridiculous.
It's quite important that he does come here for US and UK relations, but due to the simple fact that America and the UK have such a great relationship.
Trump has drawn rebuke when he retweeted anti-Muslim videos from a British far-right group and when he accused British intelligence agencies of spying on his election campaign. Still, British officials maintain that the two countries' special relationship remain intact. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, London.
British Airways Sunday resumed service to Pakistan after more than decade-long hiatus. It stopped flying to Pakistan in 2008 after a suicide bombing attack that killed more than 50 people at a Marriott hotel in the capital, Islamabad. But security situation has since improved there, and it's dispatched its first direct flight from London to Islamabad on Sunday. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has embarked on a two-day visit to North Macedonia. It's expected to become the next country to join the Western Military Alliance. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today's Monday, June 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Liberian government denies President Weah has accused his own vice president of financing the planned June 7 anti-government protests.
The vice president and the president are working together cooperatively. There is no discord between the two of them. This allegation was made by one of the organizers of the protest, Senator Samuel Johnson.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. The acting chairman of Vice President Joe Howard Taylor's party will explain the origin of the allegations. Many are arrested in weekend anti-government protests in Cameroon, and Kenya issues a new bank note to deal with money laundering and counterfeiting.
The older 1,000 shillings series, they are being used for illicit financial flows in Kenya and also other countries in the region. These are grave concerns that would jeopardize proper transactions and the conduct of commerce in our currency.
Patrick Onjoroge is the governor of the Central Bank of Kenya. A new report details the experiences of women released from Boko Haram captivity. And our Indigenous Languages series continues this morning with a focus on the Igbo language of Nigeria. Those stories plus Samson Omale's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The National Patriotic Party, NPP of Liberia, says it is troubled by rumors that President George Weah might have told international partners that Vice President Joe Howard Taylor is the mastermind and financier of the planned June 7 anti-government protest. The delegations from the African Union, Economic Community of West African States, and United Nations were in Liberia over the weekend to meet with both the government and leaders of the Council of Patriots, organizers of the June 7th protest. John Gray, acting national chairman of the NPP, says the party has been and will continue to be a peaceful party, and that the allegations against Vice President Taylor are false.
The senator who is Chief Dr. Joe Howard Taylor is the Vice President of Boko Haram. We think she has been giving her best of service to the body politics of our government at this time. And so we felt that to have accused her in that form and manner, it wasn't good for our body politics. And so we thought to come in right away and clarify the minds of Liberia and inform the international community that there has been no plan. There will be no plan. We are consistent. Even though we see that we have not been giving our fair share of the pie, but we are in the government, and so we are trying to serve the government as best as we can.
Tell me, is the Vice President, Joe Howard Taylor, is she happy?
From what I see, I want to say happiness is not the word I would like to use, because she has been very consistent with the party, keeping us at bay. There would have been a lot of guards who would have raised a lot of issues, but she felt that we should not raise issues because we were part of putting the government together, and she felt that there would be a time when the government will give MPP a fair share. And so she has been keeping her bay, and we have been following her footprints. And she's not very happy. I don't want to assume that she's very happy that her people are not in job, but at the same time, to go with a shooting statement of trying to destabilize government or overthrow government, I think it's too much off the track.
Mr. Gray, so you are saying that members of the NPP are not happy because you feel that your members have not been given enough positions in the government. That's what you're saying.
That's fair enough. I mean, I wouldn't say less than that. There shouldn't be any reason why we felt that we worked seriously to put the government in place, and then we were entitled to, because we had come up with some agreement that when the government was elected, when the election was over, that the governing council of the coalition will meet, and that all parties will have a fair share in the rule of government. But we have not seen that happen yet in the case of the NPP. And so I would be remiss if I say that all NPP parties are very, very happy with the running of the government. Now, we have run government before. We have the experience in government, and we know what it means for Liberia to be destabilized at this time. And so we are not part of it. We have been through this for some time, and we think we should just let the ball roll.
You can understand why I asked the question, is the vice president happy?
The vice president cannot be happy I don't want to assume that and to say that I'll be thinking less of the vice president. I'm sure the vice president would like to see every Liberian employed or at least doing something in the government. And I don't think the vice president could be very happy under the conditions that our people are not in job.
Mr. Gray, thank you very much for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
You're welcome.
John Gray is acting national chairman of the National Patriotic Party of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Liberia's information minister says allegations that President George Weah might have told international partners that Vice President Jewel Howard Taylor is the mastermind and financier of the planned June 7th anti-government protest are false. Eugene Nambuye says the allegations are part of tactics by what he calls some political forces that bent on sowing seeds of discourse in Liberia. Mr. Nambuye says President Weah and Vice President Taylor are working together cooperatively.
Firstly, it's totally untrue and ludicrous that the president has been accused of telling high-level diplomats like the head of ECOWAS that his own vice president is linked to the protest that has been planned for June 7. It is absolutely untrue. Mr. President did not at any time make such position to the head of ECOWAS. So it's just another of the tactics by some political forces in the country to sow seeds of discord in our country.
Mr. Minister, where do you suppose, because I asked the chairman or the acting chairman of the NPP party to say, okay, is the vice president herself happy? So let me ask that question to you. Does President Weah feel that the vice president is happy?
The vice president and the president are working together cooperatively, and there is no discord between the two of them. Now, this allegation was made by one of the organizers of the protest, Senator Samuel Johnson. So it's not a rumor. It was a false allegation made by Senator Johnson of a matter which did not happen at all. So I don't like people saying that it is a rumor. Senator Johnson publicly on radio made this very false and malicious allegation, which, you know, is totally untrue. So why should we be reacting to some of the machinations by these people? They say they want to exercise their fundamental rights to assembly as guaranteed by the Constitution. The government says, yes, you have a right to free assembly, and we will protect that right, as we will protect the rights of other citizens to move about freely and to protect lives and property. So why are all these machinations happening? It's happening because these people, since the elections, have still not accepted the result of the elections in practice. And it is members of the opposition who are carrying out all these lies and disinformation. Mr. President and Madam Vice President continue to work together very cooperatively.
Minister Nambuye, the answer I got when I asked Mr. Gray whether the Vice President was happy was that the Vice President cannot be happy if her people, because the NPP is part of the ruling coalition, and the complaint or the statement he gave me was that since the election, members of the NPP have not had any positions in the government.
Well, that is an internal matter for the leadership of the CDC coalition to address. As the spokesperson of the government, I can confirm to you that Mr. President and Madam President and the entire apparatus of the executive branch continue to work together very cooperatively and harmoniously. If there are internal issues within the Coalition for Democratic Change, as you say, have been raised by Mr. Gray of the NPP, there are internal mechanisms within the CDC to address these differences. But the position of the government, which is clear for all to see through the way they work, is that Mr. President and Madam Vice President continue to work together harmoniously.
Mr. Nambuye, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you always.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Eugene Nambuye is Liberia's information minister. You are speaking with me from Madrid, Spain. Today is Monday, June 3rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. At least 73 people were arrested in weekend demonstrations in Cameroon as thousands of supporters of Maurice Kamto, the man who says he won the October 2018 presidential election, defied a heavy police presence. As Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, the protesters were demanding the immediate release of their party leader and scores of his supporters who have been jailed since January.
Hundreds of supporters are shouting Saturday at the Yaoundé city center, demanding the immediate and unconditional release of opposition leader Maurice Kamto and all those who were arrested with him in January 28 and held in detention camps in the capital city Yaounde. 27-year-old businessman Mustafa Ali says he will continue protesting until they find justice, which he says is being denied to them by Cameroon President Paul Biya, his government, and the institutions he has created.
Ils ont demandé à ce qu'on libère immédiatement tous ceux qui ont été emprisonnés, le président Elu Kamto.
He says no one will stop them from pressing for freedom for Kamto and those supporters arrested at the beginning of the year. He says even though Kamto has not been inaugurated, he nonetheless is legitimately the president of Cameroon. At least a dozen people, including Kamto's first vice president Mamoudou Mota of the MRC party, have been arrested and detained in Yaounde and Douala. The strong police presence and their anti-riot equipment did not deter demonstrators in several towns, including Douala, Banjoun, Bafoussam and Bouda. Cameroon had banned protests in most of its cities, saying it was a threat to peace. Lejeune Bellambella, Cameroon's Minister of External Relations, warned last week during a meeting with diplomats, United Nations staff, and international NGOs that the planned protest would not be tolerated.
Toute action, alors, de remise en cause de la décision.
Mbella said any political action or initiative that questions the legitimacy and legality of Paul Biya as president of Cameroon is tantamount to undermining Cameroon's state sovereignty and is intended to disrupt public peace. He says the country's Constitutional Council examined and threw out as baseless all petitions filed by those who contested the election and Cameroon's institutions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
A report out this month details the experiences of women released from Boko Haram captivity and the abuses they receive in international displacement camps. Vincent Foucher, author of the report, tells Ricky Stryak that not only this dangerous for the women, but it also discourages other fighters from leaving Boko Haram to try and reintegrate into society.
The way the pre-Boko Haram social network receives female returnees like that is, you know, we hear very varied reports. Sometimes they accept them back in, sometimes even with children born from the Boko Haram fighter, but sometimes they reject them. And we heard stories about parents actually turning away kids, young women, even when they had been abducted and forced to marry Boko Haram fighters because they felt it was not safe. They had no idea what had happened during those years when the young women were away, and they did not trust them anymore. Series of things. And it's essentially about not having access to a social network anymore. So those women end up on their own in IDP camps, sometimes with children, and it's very difficult for them to, you know, find employment, find solidarity. And it forces a number of them, for instance, to engage in survival sex, you know, which is basically the exchange of sexual favor for some protection by, you know, a camp official or, you know, even a relatively better off male IDP who can give them a little food, maybe a work opportunity.
If people who are still in Boko Haram see that the people who have left aren't accepted really back into a society, and obviously, like in these communities, like societal acceptance is also survival often, does it affect the likelihood that some people will leave Boko Haram and come back into the communities?
Yes, I mean, this is important. Well, first of all, because a number of, in themselves, these abuses are problematic. And you know, the rights of those women should be protected. But there are also a larger political dimension to that, because those women, some of them, actually have already gone back to Boko Haram, and especially to the new Boko Haram faction on Lake Chad, which is offering better prospects than the other faction. And the fact that they are badly treated, well, you know, it has an impact on the likelihood for those fighters. Some of them are tired, some of them want out. But the women don't have very good things to say about the experience of return. So that's another very important dimension, a very political dimension of the treatment, of mistreatment of female returnees.
Who has the power in this situation to make decisions when we talk about the protection of these women, when we talk about their ability to survive? Do they have any representation within the IDP camp at a decision-making level?
Yeah, no, the IDP camp is a very layered structure of power. You know, Nigeria is a federal state, so there is the federal state, and then there is the state of Borno state, the federated state of Borno, also has an impact. They have different agencies being involved in the camps. The military are present. Then there is also presence from the militias.
That was Vincent Falcher, a researcher with the French National Center for Scientific Research. He was speaking to Ricky Schreier from Paris. Kenyans have 90 days to trade in their old 1,000 shilling note before it is banned on October 1st this year. Central Bank of Kenya Governor Patrick Njoroge says the move aims to curb money laundering and counterfeiting. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The unveiling of the new Kenyan currency notes has been criticized by many Kenyans despite of the move geared towards curbing counterfeit currency and money laundering. Speaking during the marking of 56th Kenyan Independence Day, the Central Bank of Kenya Governor Patrick Njoroge has given Kenyans up to 1st of October to trade the 1,000 shilling note currency that will not be valuable after the expiry of the given period.
The older 1,000 shillings series. They are being used for illicit financial flows in Kenya and also other countries in the region. These are grave concerns that would jeopardize proper transactions and the conduct of commerce in our currency. To deal conclusively with these concerns, all the older 1,000 shilling series shall be withdrawn. By a Gazette notice, all persons have until October 1, 2019 to exchange those notes.
The new notes bear an image of the iconic Kenyatta International Convention Center and the first president Mzee Jomo Kenyatta's statue found in the middle of the fountain. Njoroge has, however, assured Kenyans that the Central Bank of Kenya stood by the constitution on the production of the new generation banknotes and coins.
The design features that best meet central bank's technical requirements serve the public aspirations and capture the spirit of the constitution. The Central Bank of Kenya has now completed the process of producing the new generation banknotes in accordance with the constitution and all applicable laws.
The Constitution of Kenya 2010 states that notes and coins shall not bear the portrait of any individual. President Uhuru Kenyatta said that money stolen from the taxpayers must be recovered and the criminals charged. Kenyatta says the short notice to have the old notes first out will help identify the criminals involved in money laundering.
The judiciary must therefore deliver justice with cases being heard and determined expeditiously. Money must be recovered, culprits must vacate their positions, and people must serve jail terms for the process to come to full circle. We must, fellow Kenyans, return to that time when honesty and modesty were not traits of weakness.
On the other hand, the U.S. envoy to Kenya, Cale Makata, has welcomed the unveiling of the new notes. On his Twitter handle, Cale said that the new banknotes is a tool that can be used to stop the plague of thievery that has for the longest time kept Kenyans from prosperity they deserve. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Our Indigenous Languages series continues this morning with a focus on the Igbo language of Nigeria. Ricky Schreier spoke to Emeka Izibo, an advocate for the Igbo language.
We have up to 40 million people speaking the Igbo language, you know, but the problem we have is that lately people stopped speaking the language, even in schools. They started penalizing kids that speak the language. So it now seems that there are fewer speakers of the language. So my advocacy was kind of trying to create awareness.
Why are fewer people speaking the language? Do you know?
Actually, I think English language, the fact that we now communicate mostly in English language, it now makes people to now drop the language and kind of try to, you know, engage more with English language.
What kind of cultural and traditional ideas can really be transmitted only through Igbo?
In Igbo language is kind of, is pure cultural, you know, because there's this celebration in every Igbo family. There's this thing we call Oji Iskola Nut in English. So Igbos have a very strong attachment with the kola nut. They believe that with kola nut, they can be able to commune with the gods. And the Igbos believe that the kola nut does not understand English.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. So the kola nut, whenever a kola nut is presented to a visitor, if they are praying over the kola nut before eating it, the prayer must be said in Igbo.
That was Emeka Ezebe, an advocate for the Igbo language of Nigeria. He was speaking with Ricky Stryak. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the news that the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has called an emergency meeting to discuss the extraordinary events that unfolded at the CAF Champions League final played this past weekend. Esperance de Sportive de Tunis defended their title with a 2-1 aggregate victory after opponent Wydad Casablanca refused to complete Friday's second leg. Yusuf Bilali had scored the only goal of the game in the 41st minute before Wydad appeared to equalize in raids. But the goal was wrongly ruled out for offside, and with the VAR system seemingly not working, Wydad protested at length. Eventually, the referee called an end to the proceeding after about 1 hour 25 minutes, with Esperance of Tunis able to celebrate being crowned champions for a second successive season. Alfred Saiki and Dejo Goyibo are sports journalists. These was their reaction to the controversial Champions League final.
If there was no VAR, the team should have been told that there was no VAR. It wasn't working. But you don't start a match and then midway you start asking. It's like you start a competition, they start asking for the rules of the competition. So we expected that decisions like that, that will probably cause confusion, will be dealt with prior to such.
If they walk out of the pitch of play because of injustice, I think for me they are right to do so. So CAF are entirely to blame because of this whole situation. Now they solve it, it's a different case scenario because they've confirmed Esperance as the champions of African football.
And now to the FIFA Under 20 World Cup. After scraping through to the knockout stages of the FIFA Under 20 World Cup in Poland, Nigeria's Flying Eagles say they are ready to battle fellow West African side, the Young Lions of Senegal, later this evening, where the winner will face either South Korea or Japan. The Flying Eagles, coached by Paul Ayobogun, qualified on Thursday after forcing Ukraine to a 1-1 draw, finishing third in Group D but went through as one of the best losers in the group stages. Senegal have remained unbeaten so far in the tournament, winning two games and posting a draw in Group A. Mali, one of the other African representatives, were rewarded for their second-place finish in Group E with a date against Argentina on Tuesday. Should they scale the hurdle against the South Americans, a tie against Italy or Poland awaits them in the last eight. Once again, here is Alfred and Deji.
The odds favor Senegal, so if Senegal go through, we're going to have a very good representative. For Mali against Argentina, former champions, it's a daunting task.
I'll probably take in just an African team to get through the quarterfinal just based on their performances in group stages, and that's the Senegalese.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, June 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Bate in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.